So this evening, then, we're taking up a special topic of interest to a student called Reincarnation in Judaism and the Bible. And of course, we did give a companion reference, an article by that name written by William Q. Judge. So before we get into this subject of reincarnation, Judaism, the Bible, we just wanted to read a single line, sort of as a appetizer to our meeting on Sunday morning about the foundation of religion. It comes right from that article, a talk by Robert Crosby. So he says, "Knowledge is religion. Actual knowledge gained through myriads of years and many existences by those who have expressed them all, drawing nearer in themselves to the very source of their being. They found the source of every other being to be the same, only the knowledge acquired and the use of that knowledge making the differences between all beings. Their knowledge is an absolutely accurate knowledge of the essence of everything in nature, which alone is the foundation of all true religion." So we'd like to begin with this thought, and that is that the hidden wisdom of the Old Testament deals with the same spiritual truths about man and nature. It is derived from the universal ancient wisdom religion. Its fundamental principles are the same as those found in the secret doctrine. And as karma and reincarnation are central tenets in the philosophy of theosophy, they are also found to be central teachings in the Kabbalah, the hidden secret wisdom of the Hebrew rabbis, which was originally passed down orally to their disciples and then systematized in written texts. By use of symbols and keys, the Kabbalists were able to unveil and preserve the hidden meaning of the Old Testament for future generations. Our threefold purpose this evening is first to rediscover the doctrine of reincarnation in the Bible, the foundational scripture that has had profound and lasting influence on Western religion, thought, art and society. Two, to be able to promulgate the significance and relevance of the doctrine of reincarnation as found in that scripture to all who would search for truth, regardless of their creed or religion. And three, to help establish the nucleus of universal brotherhood in thought, which will inevitably lead to a universal brotherhood in fact and practice. So, what are some of the important Kabbalistic texts that we can refer to regarding reincarnation in Judaism and the Bible? Well, the first we want to mention is the Zohar. It is the oldest existing text on the hidden religious doctrines on reincarnation in Judaism. It was compiled by Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai from the oral traditions of older initiated rabbis around the first and second centuries during the occupation of Jerusalem by the Romans. He was a disciple of Rabbi Akiba, who in the Theosophical Glossary we learn was an initiate in the occult sciences. The Zohar was later edited and published by Rabbi Moses Leon, who lived in Spain during the 13th century. Now, there are specific and definite references to the cycle of souls, and a judge quotes some of those references in his article on reincarnation and Judaism in the Bible. The souls, the Zohar, in the Zohar, that first Souls return to the world in different bodies for rectification, or we might say balancing, of previous actions. Two, to enable souls to complete unfinished spiritual tasks. And three, to perfect themselves and rejoin the divine. So reincarnation is not only for the purpose of learning and rectification, but for spiritual progress and evolution towards union with that divine principle, which we heard mentioned in Crosby's article. The journey of the soul through multiple incarnations depends on the soul's actions in previous lives and their present life. So they are the main ideas that we have in all the quotations available to us from the Zohar. And as we said, Judge repeats some of those. Now, the most complete and definitive teachings on reincarnation in Judaism, in the Old Testament, in other Jewish sources, and the Kabbalistic system were given out by Rabbi Isaac Luria, who lived during the 16th century in Safad, Israel. He only had a few disciples. One of his disciples, Rabbi Vital, actually compiled and published his teachings on reincarnation into a book called Shahar HaGilim, which in English is translated into The Gate of Reincarnation. It contains the most detailed and complex exposition on the principles of the soul, their origin in relation to cosmic principles, and the means by which rectification and purification of the principles work to restore harmony in the cosmos. Now, Rabbi Luria only lived to the age of 38, but his works have become the authoritative source of all modern and contemporary Kabbalistic thought and teaching. He is considered to be the greatest teacher of the complete system of Kabbalistic thought available to the public. So we actually took all the ancient sources and all the Kabbalistic sources and compiled them into the most complete system. So when you read or hear lectures or see programs today on Kabbalah being taught to the public, those teachers are all drawing upon this one source, Rabbi Luria's works, which we have in that book. Now, HBB herself often referenced in her works, including The Secret Doctrine, the teachings of Rabbi Luria, and compared them to the fundamental teachings of theosophy regarding the origin and development of the cosmos and man. So, and referenced many of his explanations for reincarnation in the Bible. So you recall that in presenting the teachings of theosophy in The Secret Doctrine, HBB would commonly show that this knowledge had been widespread and taught in many different philosophies and religions, and she would point to the identity of basic fundamental principles and teachings in all of those. And one of those, of course, was the Jewish tradition, and she drew heavily at times on the Zohar, but more specifically on Rabbi Luria's work. So he certainly was regarded as a legitimate source. And so we are, for the rest of this talk, as we expound on the presence of reincarnation in Judaism in the Bible, we're going to draw heavily on his work, which is available in an English translation. So first, we want to look for evidence of reincarnation in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And this is important because when we're talking to other folks of even Judeo-Christian and even Islamic background, since the Old Testament is a fundamental source for all their knowledge, it's good to be able to reference ideas and expressions in the Bible that indicate the widespread belief among people at that time in reincarnation. And so let's begin with the book of Job. Now, as you recall, in the story of Job, he's a righteous man. And the adversary challenges God to test his devotion. And God says to him, okay, do your best, Satan, the adversary, and let's see what happens. So bad things happen to Job. His wife leaves him, he loses all his property, his worth. He had seven sons and three daughters. They all die in a whirlwind, a catastrophe that destroys his house. And he's going around and trying to figure out why did all this happen. And he goes to all his friends. Finally, he comes to a very wise individual called Elihu. And in the original Hebrew, a Bible, Elihu says to Job, this is what God does twice or three times with the person to bring back his soul from the grave to the light of life. So, reincarnation here explains why Job had to suffer and why bad things happen to good people. And we will bring this out more as we go along, this story of Job. And so we go on, and in the book of Exodus, chapter 34, God says, is quoted saying, I bring back punishment to the third and fourth generation out of kindness and goodness. So the rabbis ask themselves, well, wait a second, why should children have to pay for the sins of their parents, or the children, the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren? Why should they have to pay for the sins of the parents? It doesn't sound like justice or anything good or kind in that, especially when we read in Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Old Testament, this thing, children should not be put to death because of their parents. Every person dies and suffers for their own sins. That, of course, is karma. So where do we get all this? And so in the Kabbalah, especially as put forth by Luria, as we mentioned, so the Kabbalistic meaning of this is God brings back the soul for 3 to 4 times to correct their ways. So you have the original transgression, and then you come back three times to try to improve or correct yourself. Your sins will pass on to you for four lifetimes, he says, after the initial transgression. You get three more chances to rectify. And for those of you who are familiar with the aphorisms of karma, you recall that aphorism that says, well, that karma will continue until the third lifetime unless actions of mitigation are taken up. And so this same idea is brought forth in the Bible. So that's how the rabbis interpreted, on the face of it, the story of Job and why bad things happened to good people, and the meaning of that phrase, passing on the sins of the parents to the children for three or four generations. It must refer there to reincarnation. But still, we say, well, yeah, but it doesn't really use the term reincarnation in the Bible. Well, that's true. Reincarnation is a later term. Really, it's really more of a French origin and wasn't really developed later. But in the Zohar and later rabbis, they use the term Gilgul. Gilgul means to roll or roll over. And it generally, in other words, to roll over from one life to another to the opportunity to rectify past errors, past neglects, Gilgul. And then we have another term. Now, this term actually appears in the Bible in Samuel, book one, in the story of David, where David is warned about his enemies. And the expression is that his enemies will be slung, their souls will be slung out of this world like a slingshot. Slung out of the world, but his soul will be safe. So this term is kafa kela, which means sling or slingshot. And The rabbis tell us, now this is found in Samuel 1, verse 25 through 29, that this is like a cosmic slingshot. The cycle of the soul is like a cosmic slingshot that hurls the soul like a stone flung from a sling across lifetimes. So that's how that term reincarnation or kafakela is mentioned in the Bible. Now, there's another term which is called akira, which means to uproot. And what this refers to is the entire soul keeps uprooting or being uprooted from one life to another until it works out its wrongdoing. In other words, it really can't take roots in heaven or in the spiritual world because it has unfinished business to do. So it's continuously uprooted from there and has to reincarnate until it works out its errors. So there's that. So why do the Kabbalists tell us that the souls have to reincarnate? And there's actually a number of reasons. We're just going to highlight five of them. One is the violation of the transgression of an actual prohibition. In other words, one does something wrong, which they definitely knew better. They shouldn't have done. They done it, didn't do it in ignorance. They did it maliciously or angrily or carelessly. They were told not to do it, that it was against natural law or whatever, and they did it anyway. So you have to come back again and again in order to rectify it, not to do it anymore, to keep trying until you stop doing it. And you will come back again and again, according to their tradition, until you learn the lesson and stop doing it. The second reason is one fails to fulfill a positive duty and law. So one comes back under karma, not just because of things they did wrong, their so-called sins of omission, but things they did not do. Reminds us of that expression in the voice of the silence that inaction, a deed of mercy becomes an action in a deadly sin. And it is this particular karmic transgression that particularly relates to the story of Job, as the rabbis will explain to us later. Another reason people reincarnate is in order to help fix another person. Not just their own, but in order to help another person. That's brought out too, also in our karmic, in our aphorisms karma. So why incarnate? The rabbi said, because you can only suffer for your past actions in a body on earth. That's where the transgressions occurred, and you can only suffer from them in a body on earth. And the fifth reason people incarnate is for spiritual evolution, the rising of the soul to its unity with the divine, and also for the restoration of cosmic harmony. And here in the Kabbalah, we have the same expression of a theosophical idea that we are intimately connected with nature. And as we act, we not only affect ourselves and other things, but we throw the entire balance of nature out of order. And karma reacts on us from nature to restore that harmony. And we can learn to become co-workers with nature and help maintain that harmony, rather than disturb. So now one of the most interesting aspects of this teaching, especially from Luria, is examples given of reincarnation. And as you know, the Kabbalistic rabbis, when they tried to look for examples, they scoured through the various texts and looked for all sorts of clues and used numerical keys relating to people's names and so forth, numerical keys, or various keys they had, and HPB said that they did have several keys to try to unlock this sequence. And very often when they teach it for an ethical reason, in order to demonstrate a principle in life relating to karma or cause and effect and reincarnation. And so we're going to begin with one of the most interesting ones, and that is the story of the generations of Adam, the story of Cain and Abel. So, as you know, Abel is murdered by his brother Cain. And Abel, in his life, had generated good karma, good qualities in his nature as a result of his good sacrifice to God, sacrificial offering, and which was accepted. But he also had some bad qualities in his life that needed to be rectified. So his good karma, his good qualities, as well as his bad karma, had to be experienced for three generations, three reincarnations, until it was rectified. And so he, as to what those bad qualities were, we get some suggestions on that. But the typical story we have that he's killed only because Cain was jealous that God accepted his sacrificial offering and not his own, Cain's own, is only half the story. So the good qualities, the good characteristics in the succeeding incarnation of that soul is first in the character of Seth and then that of Moses. So we might say the good karma, the good qualities of that soul come back manifested in Moses. But how about the bad, so-called bad karma, the lessons that had to be learned, the bad characteristics of Abel that had to be come back, if we had to come back to. So that soul first comes back, and there is a reason they give these individuals in the very name of Abel. We're not going to go into that. But the first one is he comes back to and is Laban. Who is Laban? Laban is the father-in-law of Jacob. He tricks Jacob into marrying his daughter Leah rather than Rachel, whom Jacob wanted to marry. And he continues to try to exploit Jacob. So there's some trickery going on there, but Laban never works it out. So that same soul then reincarnates into Balaam. Who is Balaam? Well, he's a sort of sorcerer that was hired by the enemies of Israel. And Balaam's, and you may remember the story where Balaam's wandering on the road and he meets a donkey who's blocking his way. And the donkey asks him what he's doing. And he's saying he's going to curse the Jewish people in the wilderness. So he's sort of an adversary. Well, he never works it out. And finally, that same soul of Abel reincarnates in Nabal, the husband of Abigail. And Abigail later becomes the wife of King David. So where's the lesson in all this? Well, as many things, we don't really see the complete picture until we see the other side of the story, and that is that of Cain. So Cain, in his jealousy, as we know, over God's acceptance of Abel's sacrifice rather than his own, slays Abel in the field, and the blood of Abel cries out from the ground. And God hears this and comes to Cain and says, "What have you done? What have you done to your brother Abel?" And that's when we hear the same famous line from Cain, "Am I my brother's keeper?" But there was also a woman involved. Who is this woman? Well, in various Hebrew sources, we learned that Cain had a twin sister. And even in the Bible, it tells us that Adam had given birth to other children later. Cain had a twin sister who would have been his wife since he was the oldest. But Abel also had two twin sisters. That's three sisters altogether. So what? Who gets the extra sister? So Cain argues that the sister should be mine because whenever there's a dual property, the extra goes to the oldest son. And Abel argues, well, no, she should be mine because she was born with me and I'm entitled to it. So they're arguing back and forth and they can't seem to resolve it. Cain's already upset because his sacrifice rejected by God. So in his anger, he kills Abel and takes his wife. Excuse me. Cain kills Abel and takes his sister as his own wife. So that's the story. So Cain's bad qualities and his karma for doing all that have to come back and have to be rectified for three generations. And so, how does this occur? So there is this individual called Korach. And Korach is one of the incarnations of Cain. He's an adversary of Moses, and he was Moses' cousin. And he accuses Moses of nepotism regarding his brother Aaron, whom Moses had made the chief priest. And he leads a rebellion against Moses and Aaron. He is swallowed up by the earth. He is swallowed by the earth for his transgression. Now, you remember that that's sort of a repetition of the previous story where Abel's blood, once he was slain, is swallowed up by the earth and is absorbed into the earth and cries out to God. What? And then the next incarnation is that of Jethro. Jethro is a father-in-law to Moses, who gives his own daughter Zipporah to Moses. So Jethro there is Cain reincarnated. Moses is Abel reincarnated. Cain, in the new incarnation of Jethro, gives his daughter to Moses and so thereby rectifies his previous transgression of stealing his wife. And then we have Mitzri. In Hebrew, Mitzri is just a name for an Egyptian, and it refers to the Egyptian that Moses kills. And this is rectification for Abel's killing. In other words, the soul that was Cain incarnates in Mitzri, the Egyptian, and just as he had killed Abel in one life, that soul that was Abel kills Mitzri. So it gets kind complicated, but the idea is they're trying to teach the process of reincarnation, where over time, in many the soul has opportunities to rectify its karma. Now, we started out with the mystery of Job, why bad things happen to good people, and we said that Job had to. Job suffered, and he was a righteous man. And how is this explained in the Kabbalah? So Terah, if you remember, was the father of Abraham. He was a maker of idols, and Abraham smashes the idols, and as a consequence, Terah is very angry with him, and he puts Abraham, his son, in jail for 10 years. That's very important to remember. 10 years, 7 and 3. He repents later, Terah repents later, and dies a righteous man. But he still has good and bad karma, good and care qualities that have to be rectified. So the soul that was Terah reincarnates into an advisor to the Pharaoh. One of the pharaohs. And when the pharaoh is persecuting the Hebrews in Egypt and making their lives miserable, he, as an advisor, stays silent. And by his silence, his failure to protest the injustice done to others, he, in a sense, inadvertently facilitates their suffering. And so he later, that soul later, incarnates as Job, who has to suffer for the sin of his omission and his making of idols and imprisonment of his son, even in previous life. So even though he eventually was righteous, he comes back as a righteous man, but he still made mistakes that have to be rectified. And the interesting thing is that Job loses. In the beginning of the story, we say Job loses seven sons and three daughters, just as, or a total of 10 children, just as Abraham was in prison for 10 years. But for those of you who read the story of Job, when at the end of the story, when he's restored and he proves himself worthy, he gets married again and has seven sons and three daughters again. An interesting coincidence that everything he lost is returned to him. It's also interesting that in the 10 plagues that are visited to the Egyptians, you know the story of the 10 plagues, there are actually seven and three plagues. The initial seven have to do with disturbances of nature, and the final three are much more intense and have to do with devastation, chaos, and death. So once again, that idea of seven and three, the 10, come out in the Kabbalah in several ways. So we're going to finish up here briefly, just with a summary of the teachings on reincarnation in Bible and Judaism, as brought forth and emphasized by Luria and pointing to the various reference. And the first is that the real person is the spiritual element within the body. The body is not the person. It is only the clothing for the person. You are, in essence, a soul. The body includes one's personal nature. So the body and the personality are not the immortal soul. That spiritual essence is the real person or individuality. The personality and the body are only the clothing. The soul's situation in this world derives from the state of the soul, in other words, the qualities, the characteristics of the soul, and its actions in this world rebound back into the state of the soul. So, not only our situation, where we find ourselves in the world as a result of our own inherent characteristics, but as we act, we impress, we add to, or for good or ill, the qualities of our soul, which therefore sets up our reincarnation in the next life. Sounds a lot like those ideas of the cities and the elementals. So what the soul does in this world may also harm or benefit the world. Because of our interconnection, everything the soul does not only affects their nature, but can harm or benefit the world. The soul may act to blemish itself or rectify it. Elements of the soul that are not rectified roll over and reincarnated. So those personal, those lower tendencies, those tendencies in our mind that are blemishes that need to be worked out, these are those that come over that are incarnated or expressed again in order to be rectified. Each principle of the soul needs to be purified. Reincarnation continues until it is done. And we're not going to go into the details of the soul as brought out in the Kabbalah, but it has its equivalents to our astral nature, our karmic nature, our lower mind, our manasic or mind principle. Each of these aspects of the soul has to be purified and has to be lifted and has to be corrected. And our incarnations continue until that process of purification is completed. Reincarnation continues for the soul until it is rectified and reached the highest level of spiritual perfection, purification. There are some souls who no longer need to reincarnate and continue to do so out of compassion in order to benefit others. So, of course, there is much more that we could say, but we wanted to highlight these things just to help us get a better understanding of how deeply entrenched this idea of reincarnation is, not only in the Bible and is only the only logical explanation for some of the things that occur in the Bible, but in talking with other people of a Western orientation, we can use terms and point to things that are relevant from their own tradition to at least to open up to their minds to the possibility of of this idea of reincarnation and karma. So we'll stop here and we'll invite any questions or comments that you may have. Yes, Theosophy Hall.
And when we were reading the article in the book and when and during the talk, it was mentioned that so and so was a reincarnation of this person, and another one was this person, but the time period between those reincarnations doesn't sound as though. I mean, we talk about the 1500-year cycle. It doesn't seem like it was that long, or.
Well, yes. So the 50, yes, the average is 1500 years, and we know that for the individual, that can be greater or less than that. That it all relates to the individual karma as well as the general karma of the race. Yes, that a teaching of 1500 years as a general. Teaching in the Kabbalah is not emphasized, at least in the Kabbalistic texts that we have available. We know that much of it is hidden and secret. And in some cases, the incarnations can be quick, as taught in Theosophy, and sometimes they can extend over a long period of time. In the concept of the Kabbalists, the time period's irrelevant. Because time to the soul is different than time to the body. It's all more of a reflection of what needs to be done and what circumstance will allow it to be accomplished. So, yes, that 1500 year period. But the same is true. We've just recently finished an article called Karmic Visions. And a connection was made between a character in France and then a character living 100 years, several 100 years later in Germany, in Prussia area. And the idea was presented that this was the same soul incarnated, but the period there is not 1500 years either. So it's not something that held as a standard for every individual, just the general. Average. Yes, TK. Can't hear you yet.
Okay. We wonder why, and we asked a rabbi once why reincarnation is not taught generally in on Saturday at the synagogues or whatever. And his response was very kind of dismissive. Oh, you'll never hear about reincarnation at any of those meetings. And he was very, it was, and we look back and we wonder, did he just not want to talk to me about it? Which was fine if he didn't want to talk to me. But I think it was serious. And I've never heard any of my Jewish friends talk about reincarnation that they've learned in the synagogue. What, we wonder why that is.
Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, as is part of the oral tradition, and it's part of the hidden wisdom. So generally, it was not taught publicly It's something that was passed on to by word of mouth, and not really written down in any codified way that was available to the public until the 12th, 13th century by Rabbi Leon. And of course, when writing it down, it started to have tremendous influence throughout the Renaissance and throughout Europe, and affected even Christian versions of the Kabbalah. But it had been secret. It was only taught to the rabbis and their disciples, their few future disciples. So there were a large group of rabbinical schools that were not privy to these keys. And what's interesting is that there's a whole school of rabbis which have their strong population today, who only base their teachings, their interpretations on what appears literally in the Bible. And so a very famous rabbi living around the Middle Ages, very famous, said, "No, we don't teach reincarnation. We don't believe it because we don't think it's inherent in Judaism. It's not mentioned per se in the Bible. We believe that it was borrowed by Judaism from other cultures." And that's partially true because there is a lot of, in the Bible, that's borrowed from other cultures. These ideas spread throughout the world. People interchanged, they exchanged ideas. The Hebrews themselves were in captivity for several hundred years in Babylonia during the seminal time of the development of their translation of their Old Testament. And later translations were influenced by the Greeks. And so it's very possible that there was an absorption of these ideas from other sources. But then there's a whole line of rabbis going back, back to the times of that time in Chaldea, for several hundred years, that taught this secret wisdom, that taught this line of wisdom. And so there are little rabbis that don't not do not accept, or who reject and don't even teach Kabbalah. It's because they don't have access to it, and they only rely on the written text, as was seen. So you see that two schools. And even as we'll see, we'll read the Bhagavad Gita, and we'll see Krishna talks about this school and that school and this interpretation and that interpretation, and tries to bring it all together. So in every system, there are different approaches. But we think, in spite of that, because of in the last 100 years, the Kabbalists have changed their entire attitude. And as was said, they were preserving it for future generations, decided the time was right to make it more public, and at least in certain ones of their teachings. And we hear a lot more publicly about Kabbalah and this idea of reincarnation in Judaism. So, some catching up to do. Yes. Yeah. Pro, yeah, let's see. MDW. Yeah.
Well, I asked the rabbi, but he happened to be Orthodox or Hasidic,
Oh, yeah.
and he was very willing to discuss reincarnation. Now, but they had a very specific view on the stream of reincarnation, but he did acknowledge that we came back. But this was a very Orthodox. They are quite separate, from the mainstream of Judaism,
Right.
as far as the way of life and so forth. They're very, very disciplined, I guess you would call it.
Well, there's a whole segment of so-called Hasidic or mystical rabbis. We hear a lot of them teaching publicly today. But remember, all their sources, all their go back to that one authority, Rabbi Luria in the 16th century. It all goes back to him. So when they're teaching, you're giving out his teachings. And there's a lot more public expression. of that. So yes, there are many, many. There's rabbis in both camps. There's teachers in both camps. But besides what you still can point to what one group says, it's an integral part there. It's another way of looking at it. And you can point to expressions in the Bible that give reference to it. Just ways of opening up to people to the possibility of thinking about it. And not just depending on what a person tells them, but to begin to check, test, and verify it for themselves. Yes, follow up there.
Yeah, well, but it becomes also very curious that we had also asked that question to a minister, evangelical, in fact, and they became inflamed with me, that I could not speak this. I could not. This is not. And he was actually sort of jumping around, like I thought I really touched a button. But yes, I found it astounding that he would have that reaction.
Well, for those of you who may have read or remember reading that novel by George Orwell, 1984, a serious crime was a thought crime, punishable by death. And basically, if you even thought or in your speech or activity gave any indication that you believed something that was against the ideology of the state, you would be put to death. And that's basically what an anathema is in the early Christian church. You cannot think an idea, you cannot speak an idea, you cannot teach an idea, you cannot believe an idea that is opposed to the dogma at that time. And at the Council of Constantinople, one of the councils of Constantinople, the idea of pre-existence and then reincarnation, which had been part, an integral part of Christian tradition, carried on through the Gnostics and several church fathers and various indications in the Bible, was stricken and declared anathema. And so it became a crime punishable by excommunication, which meant that you had to forfeit all your property and you couldn't get into heaven. You had to go to eternal hell and damnation. So that had a very strong influence and continued to have an influence for a long time. And it wasn't until we got to the Middle Ages that we begin to see groups here and there of Christian mystics and sects beginning to talk about it, or at least some in very code, and so they wouldn't be persecuted. And then more and more, we have certain mystics talking about it. Until finally today, there are consistent polls that show 25% or so people believe in the West, in the Americas, believe in this idea of reincarnation, even though it's not part of their previous tradition or upbringing, just a soul recognition. Wherever thought has struggled to be free, there we see some aspect of the theosophical movement. And we know throughout our history, not as in humanity, not only in the East, but in the West, there have been times when any variation from the accepted dogma, authority, whether it's scientific, religious, social, was met by suffering, to suppress it. But there have always been those who carried it forward, either in secret or in silence, or talked about it in code. Like, for example, the Masons and the alchemists spoke of these ideas, but they used symbols, symbolic terms that they understood and would be understood by others who had the keys, but not so obvious that it would invite the persecution of the authorities. Yes, MDW.
So we live in a time where thought is free for the most part. But as we see, as we become a little more aware, we see that the majority of people aren't free. You know, that they don't have a center or a place where they can retreat to. It's everything is on the outside and there's nowhere to go to. So I don't know what my question was.
Well, there are certainly parts in the world where thought is less free than others, and there are actually governments and agencies that and groups that suppress the physical expression of certain ideas and actions, and it's a crime, punishable, to express certain ideas. But even in where we are not in that environment, there are interchains, are there not, that keeps our thoughts from being free. One is our dependence on outside authority, our superstition, our ignorance, our personal tastes and prejudices. All these inner chains can be ways in which we cannot be free in our thinking, which is one of the reasons, whether we're looking at from the Kabbalistic tradition or from the universal tradition of theosophy, that in order for the soul to be freed from the influence of the senses and the desires, and to purify itself and reach to either higher states of existence or experience or unification with the divine, from which all souls have come, it has to purify its lower vehicles, as we mentioned in the Kabbalah. These lower vehicles of our nature have to be purified so they no longer are chains. And so that's the inner work. That's the mystical work mentioned in the Kabbalah that brings unification finally. Are there any particular questions on this or other aspects of the philosophy or Kabbalah or terms that you'd like to bring up at this time? We have a some extra time here. Well, we think then, as we said, this is a good intro to our more general consideration on Sunday, the foundation of religion, and the point made there that we're going to expand on, that there are certain fundamental truths, certain laws of nature, which are knowledge that have been known across time in all different cultures and expressed in so many different ways and different sciences and religions and philosophies, Eastern and Western, that points to a fundamental source of knowledge and a fundamental foundation of knowers and experiencers throughout the ages who bring forth and preserve these ideas. They are, you might say, the sustainers and the preservers and the regenerators of the theosophical movement across time. We, of course, just try our best to be their companions in that effort. So this is sort of one way of exploring that, but we can approach it from a number of different avenues in our own tradition that we were brought up with, or pick a tradition that you're completely unfamiliar with. Maybe it's one from the East or Middle East or Native American or one of the Aboriginal tribes or one of the Native tribes in the islands or one of the philosophers, Eastern and Western, that you might be interested in, and take a deep dive into there. And as I said, these ideas, these truths, are found everywhere. point to this knowledge. So if there are no other questions or comments, we'll just thank you for spending some time with each other this evening, and make the rest of the evening and the weekend a good one. Take care.
Bye, guys.